Okay, we're going to start the committee hearing. Call State Government Finance to order. I don't think we have any minutes in the folder that I'm seeing. Oh, I missed them. Here we go. Who would like to move the minutes this morning?
I would love to move the minutes for you, Madam Chair.
Representative Nash moves the minutes for March 17th. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
The minutes are adopted. Members, we're going to start off with Representative Hackbarth. We have House File 460. Representative Hackbarth, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I am going to, what we're going to do for all of these bills, they're just going to be laid over. They can be heard in capital investment at any time. They don't need us to act on these at all, but we thought it would be helpful for us to see them at least in committee. So, good. Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know time is short. I'm going to just defer to my testifiers at this time, and they can tell you what the bill is.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman, my name is Gary Botzik. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Conservation Federation. And our membership is predominantly sportsmen's groups throughout the state, many of which are in your districts. They have very strong, unique relationships with shooting ranges. Either they have their own shooting range or they have a working relationship with a shooting range, which is obviously paramount to our mission, which is protecting the great outdoors. We were big on the constitutional amendment and continue to work hard for habitat and protecting anything that's good for the outdoors. And ironically, getting our kids outside has become a bigger and bigger problem. And these shooting ranges out of nowhere have become an excellent magnet, an excellent opportunity to get our kids off the couches, get them out of their bedrooms, get them off their machines, and get them outside. Mm-hmm. And Jim Sable, I invited from the U.S. High School Clay Target League is on his way, so I hope he's here in time to testify. But he's almost single-handedly put this program together. There's well over 400 schools now that have shooting range or clay target teams on their in their program. And it's not just young boys, it's young ladies that are shooting too. And that's the news on the street, is that the young ladies outshoot the guys. And I guess that shouldn't surprise us. They do in so many ways. But we're so proud of the DNR match program that's out there, 50-50 match game and fish funds being used to improve and expand the shooting ranges out there in Minnesota. And this is where these teams from Annandale and Delano and all over Minnesota are going to these shooting ranges. Obviously, high schools don't have that on their campus. They may have a football field, track field, et cetera, et cetera. They're probably never going to have a gun range on their facility, and probably shouldn't. But the track record, no pun intended, speaks very strongly for the safety for this sport is tremendous. No one's ever been injured or hurt, yet alone killed. Great program. Well, bottom line is this legislation takes the next step. House File 460 would begin the process of site design, site location, find a site, number one, for a metro county, and the outstate folks are going to have something to say about this, a facility that could be an Olympic-style type of a facility that could be used for the state tournament, and for other regional shoots that would occur, including not just Minnesota guys and gals, but also folks from out of state. So regional, national competition, which again would draw money into Minnesota as well from an economic development tool. So this is a very good piece of legislation. We worked hard with Representative Dill and Representative Hackbarth over the years to get the match money through Game and Fish Fund. This is the next logical step that we need to begin through the bonding process. So, with that, Madam Chairman, I would yield to my friend Tim over here, and we'll buy some time for Mr. Sable, if that's
actually
possible.
Mr. Sable did walk in the door if he wants to join.
I'll give him my seat, and he'll come right after Tim.
Sounds good. Welcome. If you please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Tim Spreck. I'm here today speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Weapons Collectors. Minnesota Weapons Collectors is a very large, broad-based organization throughout the state of Minnesota. Many of you are familiar with them. They not only are involved in the promotion of collecting, but they also get involved in a lot of different issues where firearms are involved. This is a natural for the weapons collectors to be in favor of, because young people need to have a facility that is safe, that is well run, and where they can learn the proper way to handle firearms and also to be able to indulge in the sport shooting that Mr. Botzek just described. This is a hugely growing segment of high school sports. Very important for people to have facility. We were talking to a young man earlier this morning, and you know, there just are not enough facilities available right now where people can go out and sport shoot. So this is critically important. All of you know Representative David Dill, who I consider to be a personal friend we lost last year. He, along with Representative Hackbarth, have been great advocates for this bill, and it is something that is greatly needed. So we would hope that you would seriously consider and help move this ball down the road so that we can provide the facility that these young people need to keep them outside and give them opportunities for something other than just sitting on an iPad. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And Mr. Sable, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Mr. Sable is a constituent of mine, so glad to see you this morning. If you want to state your name for the record.
Sure. My name is Jim Sable, or James A. Sable, if you're looking for a formal name. Do you want me to say anything about where the program is today?
If you would, yes.
Okay. I have a little map that we just printed out yesterday. You're not going to be able to see it that well. But
you know what, Mr. Sable, will ask the page and he can maybe pass it around for folks.
The number of schools participating in the program this year is around 500. Last year we had 8,600 students in the program. This year we have 10,191 registered, and that's just in Minnesota. This year we have 12 states in the program. That's up from 3 states last year. Last year in Minnesota, Wisconsin, North Dakota. And this year, we're actually from coast to coast, and New York came into the program, and Oregon came into the program. Without talking about all of that, the skeet program, which was added just a couple of years ago. The reason this whole program started is because gun clubs and shooting ranges were going out of business at the rate of almost 10% per year. Skeet was in a lot worse shape than trap shooting was. And so we're trying to breathe life into both of them. It's obvious that the trap shooting program worked, so now we're doing the same thing with skeet. We only have 243 kids in the program this year, but we turned away 1,500 kids because of a lack of facilities. There's 399 gun clubs and shooting ranges in the state. Of those, only 15 have skeet fields. So there isn't a great deal of opportunity for kids, even if they want to do it, to get involved in it. So the grant funds that the DNR has been administering was for trap fields only. And so this year they have finally included skeet fields in it. So we're hoping in 2017 a lot of those kids that signed up for it and were told they couldn't participate because of a lack of skeet fields, we hope they'll be back. And the number is pretty much following what happened with trap shooting. With trap shooting, we started with 6 kids. 6 went to 13, 13 went to 30. 30 went to 129, 129 to 257. This is the number of schools I'm talking about. And 347 up to 500. And if the skeet fields existed, I think the very same thing would be happening because we projected with states they would follow the model that we had. and they're actually doing quite a bit better than that. We expected to go from 3 to 6. We went from 3 to 12. So it's one of those programs where we get a lot of calls from parents saying that they're appreciative of the fact that the kids are outside in the fresh air doing something as opposed to being sequestered in their room with electronic games. I don't know if that means anything or not. My kids are all grown and out of the house before that happened, but the parents that do call are truly appreciative that their kids have found a way of getting outside. And they usually follow that up with the comment, you know, not every kid is cut out to be a football player. And that's exactly true, especially the about 18 or 19% that are girls in this program. It's a gender-neutral program. Boys and girls are on the same team, as are adaptive students. It's an all-inclusive program. We don't segment them at all. All one team. And there are no bench riders. Everybody that joins the team participates in it.
Thank you, Mr. Sable. Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe we could have Mr. Sable talk a little bit about the facility that's where you have up in Alexandria right now and mm-hmm. what's going on there and what the critical need is for this facility.
Okay.
Mr. Sable.
We have a state championship up at Alexandria, and all of the kids are invited to that. And typically 80% of them come up. And the reason we do it that way is that there are three categories based on the student's average. Either they're, and it has nothing to do with grade or age, but they could be a novice shooter, a JV shooter, or a varsity shooter. And they get to compete novice against novice, JV against JV, varsity against varsity. So a lot of these kids that would never have an opportunity to be in a state competition have it here. The people that are in the varsity category and are the winning teams and winning individuals from the state championship go on to the Minnesota State High School League state tournament. And we started out with a one-day tournament up at Alexandria, and last year it was a six-day tournament. We had 5,100, I think it was, students up there. And this year, with over 10,000 kids registered, we figure this is going to be an eight-day tournament. And everybody says, well, how many days do you really think it's going to be before you're maxed out? And my answer to that is 5 days. So we're already 3 days over what the max ought to be. And we don't know, you know, in 2017, if it gets bigger than that, the only answer is going to be to start cutting kids out of the program and not allowing them to be there, because we just can't go 2 weeks with something like this. The field up there is the largest field in the state. They have 19 traps. And I believe the next largest has 10 or possibly 12. So with 19 traps, it's pretty well maxed out. The other thing that we're finding about the program, the program, as I said, was designed to save the shooting sports. At the Plymouth Gun Club that I belong to, the average age of our members in 2001 was 56, and average was really misleading, because if we had gone to median age, it would have painted a much grimmer picture. We had a couple of 21-year-olds that brought the average way down. So if you take two 70-year-olds and a 21-year-old, you got 161 divided by 3 is 53 point something. Today, the average age of our members is 40. And I've gone to the club on Saturday to unlock the gate and had 17 cars parked out at the gate waiting to be let in, all kids. So they participate, and they participate in large numbers. So I think the sport is here for at least another couple of generations.
Thank you, Mr. Sable. Representative Hackbarth, any wrap up at all? Or?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, for your indulgence. And I can tell you that this is going to be a facility that is going to attract people from all around the country. This is not going to be just a one-weekend deal or a one. It's going to be continual, and it's going to be drawing people from all around the country. And up in Alexandria, there's a big area there where they attract campers, and it's really, really a big deal and getting bigger all the time. So that's why this legislation is here. Thank you, members, for indulging us.
Thank you. I've got Representative Albright.
Mr. Sable, thank you for bringing this to the committee. My family is a direct participant of your work in this area. My son 2 years ago was runner-up of state, and the difference between winning and losing was one clay. So it is a very, very competitive sport, and my daughter now participates. It's not only about the young, but as Representative Hackbarth alluded to, there's a lot of folks that like to spend their weekends traveling the circuit shooting clays, but then they also go into town and they spend their money at the restaurants and the hotels and the gift shops, and so there is a ripple effect to the efforts on your behalf, bringing it to a younger generation. The other generations thank you for your efforts as well.
Yeah, thank you. I'd throw in one thing. One of the neatest parts of the program that I think there was a meeting of a group of school administrators, and they called me in and they said, we've done a survey and we'd like to know if you know what the kids like best about this program. And I said, well, we've done our own surveys, and we know that the kids, 54% of them have never held a gun or shot a gun other than in firearm safety training. And they tell us that learning a brand new sport and getting to be pretty darn good at it at a relatively short period of time is satisfying to them. The school administrators said, nope. Number one answer, the new friends I've made. And I think that's a neat thing to come out of the program. Mm-hmm.
Representative Lunin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I represent the Shakopee area, and we too have a robust trap shooting team and are scrambling for acreage to do it on. We took a look at our numbers and the demographics of the kids coming in, and for every student that does get to participate, there's two that don't. So what we discovered, importantly, is the bulk, and by bulk it was over 80%, I can't remember the exact number is, of the students that participate in this are in no other school activity. This connects with a certain unique group of people, and now in Shakopee we have our FIED teachers out recruiting those, what they consider invisible kids, the kids that don't have a lot of school engagement, to come in and to belong to an experience, which is part of what you talked about, Mr. Sable, where they meet other friends and they've got a situation they belong to, and they're seeing it reflect back in on the school attendance and the behavior in school also. So we're getting a lot of benefits from it in the Shakopee area. We have the same problem, and There's another bill that's coming forward, Representative Neuberger, that on a training facility we have down in our area, we're trying to utilize that. But we feel this is a very important, very successful situation to get kids involved in some kind of club or group.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, first a question of you. Are we going to hear from the Amateur Sports Commission? Because this bill...
But I thought we'd take members' questions, then we'll ask the public if there's anybody else that wants to testify.
I was curious if we're going to hear from them, and perhaps if I could ask then Representative Hagbarth or the other witnesses. I was involved years ago when we set up the Amateur Sports Commission, and we did provide bonding proceeds, but the goal was that they be self-sustaining. And recently, Mr. Erickson, who headed for many years the Amateur Sports Commission, testified that that was still true today. So my question is, you know, how do you generate revenue, and if we did provide the bonding proceeds financially, is it self-sustaining? Because that's the goal of the Amateur Sports Commission with the various other sports that they sponsor or have facilities for.
Representative Hagbarth or Mr. Sable?
I can't give you the numbers that Alexandria Shooting Park is making off of the program, but they threw 6 million targets last June, and that means there were 6 million shots fired at least, and the park makes something off every one of those. I can't tell you how much they make off of it, but you know, whatever it is, multiply it times 6 million, and that's the number that that the park itself is making. The chamber up there said that the program brings at least $1 million into their community when you consider gas, restaurants, sporting goods, all the other stores. So it's hard to put a number on it. In our survey last year, one of the questions we ask is how many are planning on buying a new gun this year? The answer was 6,000. So you take 6,000 times a $500 to $1,000 gun, and again, unless this facility is selling guns, that doesn't mean anything to them. But what it does mean is that the people involved in the sport are spending money.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Representative Carlson, I think Ms. Roberts has some information to offer. Potentially,
I was just going to say that all of us, I think, understand the spinoff, the economic benefits that are generated by virtually all sports facilities, and this would be one. My question, and maybe Ms. Roberts will answer it, is specific to the facility itself. Would it generate enough revenue to meet the overall cost? That's my question. And so,
I think that she had a comment in reference to the Amateur Sports Commission, and I apologize for putting you on the spot. And if you don't, that's fine. We can get some more information later if that's helpful.
Madam Chair and Representative Carlson, I don't have any information on this specific project. I just had noted that for the first time, the Amateur Sports Commission is coming forward with a request for funding for asset preservation at the National Sports Center, which I think gets a little to your point. Up until this time, the Sports Center in Blaine had covered all of its costs through its operating, the revenues it was taking in, but they are now coming forward to ask for state funds.
And Madam Chair, we've had a history with the amateur sports. I mean, we built the facilities with state funds, but I was asking about the operational costs, and this may generate enough to cover the operational costs, or it may not. If it doesn't, then there should be a conversation at some point as to how that would be funded.
Sure.
If there was a need for a subsidy.
One thought on that is that Trap and Skeet are only two of the activities, as I understand it, that are going to be there. They're going to have small bore rifle, large bore rifle, handguns, archery, sporting clays, and then trap and skeet. So trap and skeet are two out of, what, six to eight.
Okay. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Sable, for your service and also for bringing this program. And I don't think the state high school is represented here today, but how does the state of Minnesota, I know it's one of the fastest growing sports, or these fastest growing sports in the state of Minnesota, how does the state high school league, in terms of their funding and so forth, you know, like other sports, you know, we have facilities for all the other sports, and now this is a little bit different because we're off site from our facilities in our schools. And where is the state high school league sitting on this program? And it's so fast growing, and what are the fees, and can some of this money be put back into the program?
Well,
Mr. Sable, if there's anybody from the state high school league that wishes to speak to that, not seeing any, Mr. Sable.
The state high school league, and in particular Dave Stead, the executive director, really deserves a lot of credit for the success that we've had, because in the very beginning, when we had nothing but an idea, and I'm saying, I know we're going to need a policy and procedure manual, what are the odds of me borrowing yours? And they were excellent. We got to use his. The goal in the beginning was to have this become a Minnesota High School League activity. However, something popped up that we hadn't anticipated, and that was that a lot of the clubs, the only time they have available for the kids is on Sunday. And the Minnesota State High School League has a rule that there can be no practice or no competition on Sundays. And the first time that came up, a young guy by the name of Ryan Johnson from Hermantown called me and said, we're going to be shooting over near Grand Rapids. The only day we can have is Sunday. Would you allow that? And I said, you know, Ryan, that's not my call. It's up to your mom and dad. If they allow it, we allow it. If they don't allow it, then it's not going to happen. And 2 minutes later, I got a call from Ryan's dad saying, let me make sure I understand this. I understand I have two choices. I can leave him in his room playing electronic games all day, or he can go over to the gun club and shoot trap. And I said, well, it's pretty close, not exact, but close enough. And he said, well, we vote for trap shooting. Well, now all over the state, there's a lot of clubs that have kids shooting on Saturday, and we have what the State High School League calls is a presenting partnership. They put on the state, they hold the state tournament, but we put it on for them. They're present, they have their advertisers and everything like that. But they don't do it by themselves. We do it in partnership with them.
Yeah, Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick follow-up. Yeah, that's kind of the way a lot of other sports are done, too, even though they're on site, whether it's Excel Center or whatever. The Coaches Association, they pretty much run the tournament with the support of the State High School League. Just last question, Madam Chair. Do they charge admissions to, like, the sectionals, regionals, or the state tournament? And does this money go back to the schools, or does it stay with the state high school league, or shared, or how does that work?
Mr. Sable.
The state high school league does not charge anything for that. We have a registration fee, and that's to cover hiring range safety officers, scorekeepers, and things like that. My wife and I have been volunteers for 15 years, so if anybody thinks that maybe we're getting rich off of this program, it is. We never had the idea of making money off of it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone from the public that wishes to testify to this bill? All right. Representative Hackbarth, appreciate you coming forward, and very interesting bill. Appreciate it. So.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
For your time, members. Thank you.
Representative Newberg, I see you've got your folks here. We've got House File 1046. Again, this is another bill that we're just hearing. We will not be making a move on this bill. Welcome, Representative Neuberger.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. I think we might have to have a brief discussion about, I don't know if this will need to go to public safety or not.
These bills are capital investment bills, and so they can hear them in public safety without them being present in public safety if they wish to.
Goodness. Well, thank you. I appreciate your time here before the committee. I'm Jim Neuberger, State Representative, Minnesota House District 15B. I've brought some testifiers with me today. Today we're presenting House File 1046. As many of you know, I'm a paramedic. I've been in one of those ambulance drivers for 28 years. 28 years ago, when I was really young, I crawled into an ambulance. I had this much driving training. And all I was told was, don't wreck the truck. We've come a long way in 28 years, suffice to say. On the other side of the equation, I have in my career been involved in two ambulance crashes, one where I was in the back working a critical patient. I was not able to be restrained. And by the grace of God, you might not think so, but by the grace of God, I'm here today as a state representative. And then one crash where I was the driver. And I can tell you that emergency driving training, it pays off, and it's a worthy investment here. What we're looking to do here, members, is to expand an existing facility. It's up at Fort Ripley. It's known as the EVOTC. We're passing some handouts around as we speak. The first phase was completed 2012. It's a driving track, and what we're looking to do is expand this. I'm going to pass around a colored sheet. We don't have a colored printer. If I get a page, I'll do this.
Thank you.
What we're doing here is the pink area is what we're looking to expand. To greatly increase the scope of the training, and that's what we're here for you before you today. This is not simply a jurisdictional training center. This would be it's not even statewide. It's regional. We would have the opportunity to allow anyone from anywhere in Minnesota who want to use this facility, they could, and we would even have the opportunity to have members or people from the five-state area come in, and we would bring in some revenue for the state because they would have to pay to use this if they're coming in from North Dakota or Wisconsin or wherever. So this facility has a good reputation, and we anticipate it to be used extensively if we're able to complete it. What we're looking at here is to continue with driving training, also emergency operations, there's going to be every kind of training. You could have police training, we could have fire training, whatever the emergency training is, it's going to be there. Unfortunately, if you saw the news today, there is a need for counter-terror training, and they'd be able to do that as well. With that, that kind of sums that up. We're looking for the ability to expand this, and I will be available here for questions if you have any.
Okay. Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to testify? All right, members, questions?
Madam Chair, I just want to introduce my two witnesses here today. Just give them a minute to speak to this. This is Jeff Larson. He's put up with me for 20 years. He works with me at North Memorial, where I currently have my real job. He's one of the emergency training, he's one of the people that trains people on emergency driving. And I just wanted to give paramedic Larson here a minute to expound on this.
Mr. Larson.
Madam Chair, members, thanks for having me this morning. Like Representative Newberg said, I'm Jeff Larson. I'm a paramedic with North. I train all of our paramedics and EMTs when it comes to all of our emergency vehicle operations stuff. This course or this emergency vehicle operations course up at Camp Ripley's been a long project in the works here. Phase one was done back in 2012. Phase two that we're hoping to get this finished, we've actually cut one phase out of this, just strictly due to cost that it would cost to add this third part of the phase in. The page that Representative Newberg has passed around, that pink section in the middle, what becomes important about this is that we can get we can have multi jurisdictions training up here at the same time. This isn't just one person or one department that can come up. We can get EMS, we can get fire, we can get police all training together, and we don't have that opportunity a lot, and those things don't arise or come about that often that we can do it. This facility really would allow us to be able to train together, work together, continue working the skills that we need to work with all the time. We can carry on, as Sergeant Merlicher will talk to, you can continue training on where law enforcement can start with a car chase or something like that, where now someone jumps out and flees and they can continue this training, where some of the other courses that are out there, some of these things, the training pretty much stops there. Okay, he gets out, he runs away. Well, now with this new part where we can add an actual town development, we're going to have a section of railroad where fire departments can work on derailment kind of things, those kind of items. But again, the where this facility is at, it allows everyone to get there, to be able to use it. It's not going to kill everyone's training budget to come up there and use it, because now each department can put in a small amount to get to this, to get that fee covered for the track for the day. It's just one of those necessary things with all of the training requirements that are required now. It would just be, I think it would be very beneficial for the entire state and the region so that they can come and use it.
I imagine they'll be adding cement trucks to their training.
Probably will be a necessity, yes, ma'am.
Who knew? Representative Newberg, your other testifier.
Madam Chair, Committee, thank you very much for the opportunity. My name is Ruben Richler. I am a sergeant with the Minnesota State Patrol and the Emergency Vehicle Operations Vehicle Contacts Coordinator, and we train on the facility every year. Every trooper that is in our organization will train or have gone through the training on this facility. As you see on the papers that Representative Neuberger had sent, there is a list of the agencies that have trained on that facility so far. We list the National Guard. I know that there's been at least seven different units that have trained there from the National Guard. So it's not just one specific unit, but several units from around the country.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions, members at all? Representative Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Neuberger, my daughter, is a paramedic as well. And one of the questions that I always ask her is, would this facility be amenable to winter type training conditions rather than going out on the roads for practice? Would this be adaptable, or is it part of the thinking to prepare rig drivers for icy conditions, snowy conditions, when cars don't move over and they should, those types of conditions that can prepare them for those types of oddities during their day-to-day, their shifts?
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This facility would be open all year round for any type of training. Should the company that your daughter works for choose to offer that kind of training, they would be able to make use of this facility if they wanted to do it in the wintertime exactly for that.
All right. Seeing no other questions, members, Representative Neuberger, thank you, gentlemen, for coming today. I appreciate
it. Thank you.
We have Representative Mahoney, House File 454. Members, I'm just going to draw your attention. Representative Mahoney does have an amendment to his bill that changes the amount. However, we're not moving this bill. It's just a part of our hearing process. But I just want you to be aware of the change in the dollar figure. Representative Mahoney, welcome to the committee, and if you want to present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry I was directing some of the witnesses. Did you say you did want to hear the amendment or not?
We aren't moving the bill at all, so it doesn't have an effect on the piece of legislation. I just want to draw members' attention that you've changed the amount so that if they have questions, they're reflecting that it's the 2.5 versus the 1.4 that you had originally.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a House File, whatever it is.
454.
454. Is a bill to provide funds to the Minnesota Humanities Center, which is in my district, to correct for asset preservation. There's a variety of things, and I'll let the witnesses go through them. I'll give you a little history of the center. Built almost 100 years ago, 1920, or thereabouts, 1925, as one of the original polio hospitals in the city. And up until it was used extensively for a very, very long time, it fell into disrepair and became a place where pigeons roosted. And in 1995-94, the neighborhood came together and said that there was a move to tear it down. And the neighborhood came together and said, no, we can't do that. Through a variety of fundraising and dollars, they were able to repurpose the center into the Humanities Center. It is now used by a variety of groups, from women veterans to corporations to community groups and politicians. I hold town hall meetings there myself. It's a wonderful facility. It is used very, very extensively, but unfortunately today, and as you see if you look through the piece that should be handed out to you already, it has multiple failures going on: the stucco, the walls, interior and exterior, the heating system, all need upgrades and or repairs and replacement. So members, that's what this $2.5 million request. That's what this will do. I brought with me three witnesses, the executive director, the architect, and I am not sure what your particular title is, but I'm sure you'll give it when the time comes. So, Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to Mr. O'Fallon.
Mr. O'Fallon, welcome. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, I'm David O'Fallon. I'm the president of the Minnesota Humanities Center. Thanks for hearing us this morning. I see that you all do have the packet, and I won't belabor the packet, except you can see the pictures.
What did you see there?
Nothing. The center has done its best at the daily maintenance, but the structure has reached a point where we really need some help to preserve it, if you will. You will see in the pictures and the assessment that was done by Mortensen, and if you need further testimony, the architect who's done the deeper analysis with us, Rafferty, and Lee Tollefson, is here from that firm. So we've done our homework on what's needed to keep the structure operational. I'd like to make a couple of points. It does serve the entire state of Minnesota. I think you can see one of my favorite illustrations in here is this map, which is near the end. 43,000 Minnesotans over the last couple of years, 205 communities, So it's a statewide asset. It's a statewide center. The idea of this is that it serves nonprofits and is the home to a lot of organizations that find its facilities really useful. We have a sampling of letters of support from Collegeville, Minnesota, from Fairview Hospital, from a charter school, and one of the ones that's most recent to us, I'd like to have her testify to it, is Women's Veterans of Minnesota have moved in with us so we can harbor and help this relatively new organization get stronger and launch them. And from that organization, I'm pleased to present the other testifier, Jill Troutner, whose letter you see also in front of you. So, Madam Chair, if I may introduce her.
Ms. Troutner, welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jill Troutner, and I live in Maple Grove, Minnesota. I grew up in Waubun, Minnesota, on White Earth Indian Reservation. I was nominated to West Point, and I graduated from West Point in 1993, and I served in Germany as a quartermaster officer in 1st Armored Division, and I also served in the Minnesota National Guard, and I deployed with them to the Balkans. I moved around a lot with my husband post our military career, and we've lived in several states, and it came to the point where he was always traveling, and I had the opportunity to come back to Minnesota where I still had ties. And I reconnected with the women veterans I'd served with, and they had started this organization, Women Veterans Initiative. We're a nonprofit. We've been pretty much self-funded. We were really struggling. And at the time, Minnesota had lost their women veterans coordinator. So WVI had decided, we're going to try to pick up this slack and this gap, and we're going to have this big event that the women's coordinator used to create, but we didn't have a space for it. And the Humanities Center gave us the opportunity to have that space. And so combined with them, Wounded Warrior helped us out, MNDVA helped us out, and we had an event that attracted almost 200 women veterans in the metro area. And that created this launching pad of awareness for us and helped us figure out what these women were looking for, and at the time, the women veterans number was almost 29,000. It started the whole license plate conversation up again, which I became very involved with. And we had an opportunity with Penny George Foundation, found out about this event and was interested, and they offered us a grant to kind of, they called it a catalyst grant, to help us kind of get a little jump start. And the fit that seemed to be perfect for us was the Minnesota Humanities Center, and with the tie-in with the Veteran Voices program, which some of us also took a real interest in. And I nominated a woman who became a Veteran Voices awardee from my hometown of Waubun, Minnesota. So for the women veterans, we've continued to build a bigger presence in the veterans community, and we're currently planning kind of another Women Veterans Networking Summit to try to reconnect with those county veteran services officers, a lot of whom are women who we don't even know, and they're across the state. And so we're working on that, and we're looking at a date in May. And I'm working with the UVLC, which, you know, I attend the MIG with Representative Detmer. And the UVLC has had this great idea of like, yeah, let's have a summit too. And we've offered the Humanities Center, again, as a location because it's handicapped accessible, which is very important. It's easy access. It's beautiful. It has a history. It's by Lake Phalen. A lot of times I'll drag the meetings out and like, we've got able-bodied people here. Guess what? We're going to walk and talk. I don't want to sit. And I've dragged some pretty out-of-shape people 5 miles around Lake Phalen. So sometimes, you know, when the weather's great, it provides a venue that has so much to offer in terms of the handicap access, the history of the building, the park system, which is one of the fabulous things about the metro area. And, you know, I could go on and on. But one of the things I came back to Minnesota, and my husband is a Southern California boy, and I needed to tie him to my state because I did not want to move again. I'm on my 7th home, and this home was stucco, so I am well aware of stucco remediation, and I know it's very expensive. And Minnesota, I'm like, stucco, what were we thinking? But the building is, it's so special. If you haven't had a chance to get in there and the details and the history, the things that were done there for the children, they're still there and they're still intact, and it has so much special character. And that gets really noticed by the women, veterans especially. They're looking around, they're taking pictures of the little architectural details, the little cornices, all those things make it feel like you're important when you're there. So I can't say enough about the building or the Minnesota Humanities Center program. My husband's on the board. He's meeting a connection with Minnesota where he's tied in as a veteran. He's also a West Point grad, and he did serve in the National Guard here in Minnesota with me as well. So he's reconnected with that part of his life, and in terms of his desire to do some public service, which the Humanities Center and their educational programs, which I have participated in some of their more civilian-type field trips, and I have to say they are highly organized, and I don't like wasting my time on anything, and I'm going to be dragging my mother and some members of my Native American community on one of their upcoming field trips. I believe it's in May. So thank you for listening, and I can't stress enough the importance that the Humanities Center has for women veterans and the veterans community as a whole.
Thank you, Ms. Trotner. Representative Hugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the testifiers for your great presentation. I've not been there, and I had made myself a note to get there, and before you even mentioned it, so I look forward to doing that. I have two questions. My first is for Mr. O'Fallon with regard to the renovation, the saving it from the wrecking ball, it sounds like, in 94 and to 95. And you mentioned that there was an organization that raised some funds, and then it was it state-funded, the repurposing and renovation of the building? Wonder if you could shed any light about, you know, how much the organization, the grassroots friends of the center might have raised, and then what kind of an investment did the state put forward in order to bring it to life? Mr. O'Fallon.
Madam Chair and Representative Pugh, I wasn't there at that time. I've only been at the center 5 years, so some of that history is not entirely clear to me. There was a large Friends of the Center that did raise funding, and I think at that point, and I will have to double back with you for the exact figures, but I think at that time the state put in about $1.5 million, and the rest was raised privately. So about another million or so was raised. The Friends of the Center, and it's gone through different executive directors, and different things have happened, and at this stage the Friends of the Center barely exist, to be quite honest. We're sort of restoring, rebuilding some things that were perhaps left in abeyance a few years back. I think we're on a really good track right now. The center is prepared to put, we've been investing all along in the fundamental repairs as best we could, but we can't raise this kind of money at this point.
Mm-hmm. Representative Putin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so my question, my follow-up question would be, have there been any other state investments in the center since then or not?
Mr. O'Fallon.
Madam Chair, Representative, not in the asset preservation capacity. We received some legacy funding, and we received some state general operating funding, and that is basically to support the keep the doors open and programming and lights on, but nothing that has been invested in the preservation of the building itself.
Mm-hmm. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, yes, I would be most interested in a recap of the funding that has occurred since, you know, since it was renovated and including at that time. So that would be great. And then I do have a follow-up question, Madam Chair. Mr. O'Fallon, you mentioned about, I believe it was Mortenson, that has prepared the cost estimate on what this project would be, and I'm just wondering what that has already cost to assess, you know, what the scope of this project. I see that it went from $1,440,000 to $2,500,000. I'm wondering what the cost was for the estimate.
Mr. O'Fallon?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm pleased to say the cost was zero. Mortenson did all this work for us for zero at this stage. It was a total deep analysis. They sent teams over. They walked, they measured, they poked, they prodded, they pried up carpet, they went up in attics, and they never charged us a dime.
Representative Pugh.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and that's my last question. Thank you very, very much.
Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. O'Fallon and Mrs. Tollefson. What year graduation from West Point?
93, Ms. Kautner.
93.
And I know your twin boys went to West Point.
2000, okay. Mm-hmm. Again, thank you for your service. And I think people should know that the Veterans Voices program is a statewide program that's providing for through the Humanities Center. And also you have a professional development for educators. Could you just touch on that? Because I think this is a program that's really caught fire in the state.
Mr. Fallon or Ms. Troutner?
Madam Chair, Representative Detmer, yes, the center serves several major thrusts right now. It is fundamentally an education center, and a huge part of the program is to bring two educators across the state, especially resources and ideas for professional development, some of it directly related to closing the achievement gap, by presenting materials from Dakota, Ojibwe, Hmong, Somali, African American, for example, that have been left out, not used, not utilized, not fully developed. One of the things I love saying about the center is we don't license anybody, we don't regulate anything, we don't control anything. So the testimony is, do we do something that people find valuable? And literally, tens of thousands of educators and people find value in using the center. So our educational materials, our thousands of educators, our literally dozens and hundreds of schools that have worked with us over the last just a few years find value in the professional development we do to help teachers reach kids in a rapidly changing world. So sort of a bottom line equation, but we have 900 original resources, literature, DVDs, video classes that we've created at the center with both private and state funding that did not exist before. So the foundation of education is the teacher and student relationship and the school and community connection. That's where we do our work.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment. If people on the committee, you should probably get out and see the center and maybe attend one of their events at the center, because it is something that really serves the people of Minnesota. Thank you.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, on that last point, I think some of us have been there through the years. It's been a while since I've been there for various events. I think the last one that I was at was a program dealing with a nursing shortage that was sponsored by someone, but using the center. I forget who it was. I know there was huge presence of MNSCU and the University of Minnesota at the time. But I've got more a curiosity question. On your front page here, it says that this building was part of the original Gillette State Children's Hospital. And maybe I should have been more observant, but do any of the other buildings still exist, or are they all gone? Maybe Representative Mahoney knows, being it's his general area.
Representative Mahoney or Mr. O'Fallon?
To my knowledge, there's no the Gillette Children's Polio Hospital, this is the only building left.
This is the only one. No. Thank you.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for what you do there. I'm sure it's a very good agency and a good program that people really enjoy, and it's something that I think we want to maintain. As I was looking over the scope of work, I noticed that almost half of it has to do with HVAC improvements for that, which I'm sure you would be very happy for comfort and so forth. But most of the time, that is considered more of an ongoing expense. It's something that we would expect that the budget would have included the various upgrades and remodeling of that. And I know we are where we're at, and we need to deal with the preservation and so forth here. My question goes on into basically about the future. Is there any thought or plans in putting dollars into the budget for these ongoing expenses that normally occur in all businesses and all agencies, knowing that in the last 20 years we now need $2.5 million? It's about $100,000 a year. Seems to be a reasonable amount to put into the figure out some sort of budgeting process for that. Can you help me with knowing whether or not you have any plans to do that?
Mr. O'Fallon?
Madam Chair and Representative Petersburg, part of the problem with the HVAC system is that it was installed to a certain level of competency, you know, 20-some years ago now. So you can maintain a system, but the system as it was installed, I think, was, to be quite blunt, compromised from the beginning. You know, people made choices with, this is the best we can do right now with the funding available. If we can install a new HVAC system, and I call your attention to the letter from Fairview Hospital, which basically says, we love you guys, fix the HVAC system, because the on-the-ground story is sometimes we can't even hear the keynote speaker in our conference. So if we are able to install an up-to-date HVAC system, then I think absolutely. We do have a maintenance provision in our budget every year, and we'd be able to maintain this. But I don't think you can guarantee that any system outlives itself 20, 25 years down the road, whether it's your home water heater, your own air conditioning system. At some point, you need to probably replace or restore at a significant level. But yes, we do invest in maintenance, for sure.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand that. I guess my discussion is more about, as you said, from day one, you knew the HVAC system was not appropriate, or at least was not up to quality. So I'm wondering if there's any way in which you could have thought about how do we build into our budget the ability to sometime in the future replace something that is a item that does wear out. In other words, when you have disposable assets, we're not, asset preservation usually has a tendency to think about those assets that are ongoing, but disposable assets, those that have a life expectancy to them, a lot of places think about that. Nonprofits, I'm aware of nonprofits. I work for a church, so I understand the difficulty that there is, but it's still something to consider, and I was just curious if you had thought anything about future needs like this.
Mr. Fallon.
Madam Chair and Representative Petersburg, and I'm so glad you work for a church. You really do understand these challenges, these budget challenges. The simple answer is yes, we do think about this. We do make budget provisions against items that you know are eventually going to wear out. Some of these things, as you can see on here, you mentioned HVAC is huge. But so, and you can see by the pictures, some of the tiling, some of the stucco, some of the leakage and water abatement in the basement. A small organization can't really anticipate exactly what will happen in the future, and some of these things are beginning to cause health and safety issues. So that is another piece of the story.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make a comment and thank you guys for partnering with the Minnesota Regenerative Publishing Project for the In Black Ink. I just learned about that project this Saturday, and Representative Rena Moran has a bill to fund that project to help tell the stories of African Americans and get that in the curriculum and provide vocational training for those who want to write or publish or do graphic design. So this is another great program to add to what you're already doing. So thank you.
Representative Earhart.
I didn't raise my hand.
Oh, my apologies.
I'd be happy to ask questions.
I'll pause. Members, any other questions? And just make sure anybody from the audience that wishes to testify. Thank you. Appreciate you guys coming forward.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members.
Members, with that, we are adjourned.